Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 7th, 1999. In the fireside room this evening is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. Today's session is titled Families in Crisis, Who's to Blame, What to Do? Family, Society, and Politics. Let's listen in.
Of things and goodies at our children, but we don't give them what they really need, which is some kind of relationship with us and other adults. So, but what happens in that family circle is really important. Then we talked about neighborhood, and I gave a couple of examples, and I had people think, first of all, about why do you live where you live? And most people had really good reasons why they chose to live where they live. And I was trying to create a little bit of sympathy and a little bit of understanding with the idea that most of us in this room have choices about where we live. And we choose to live in places that give our children somewhat of a better chance. For example, if you're living in a neighborhood where gunshots are fired all the time, where drugs is a daily reality, where there's tremendous violence, it's really tough on children. And I indicated some studies that Jonathan Kozol has done that indicates in New York State, by way of example, 3/4 of all the inmates in New York State prisons come from the same 7 neighborhoods. That should tell us something about the importance of neighborhood. And then the third circle I suggested is society. What's going on in society? And by that I meant cultural images. And we're going to deal with those mainly tomorrow. We're going to talk about the media. We're going to talk about expectations of what the good life is. A whole bunch of cultural images. And then 3 other areas I named as part of society were the existence or non-existence of government programs and supports for people. What's going on in the economy? And particularly a focus on the tax system, that all of those things have a profound impact on children and families. So what we're going to do today is focus on really those last 3 with an emphasis on economy and taxes. And I want to start out by reading one quotation, and then I'm going to introduce you to the first ever Holden Run for the Wages. Okay, that's what we're gonna hold today, right outside this door. It's all set up for us. The Holden Run for the Wages. So before doing that, let me read to you a quote from Penelope Leach. And Penelope Leach stresses that if we're concerned about children and concerned about families, then we have to be concerned about cumulative risk factors. It's another way of saying that something going wrong in each of these areas, each of those 3 circles, really makes it tough on children. But then she tries to hone in on, when you look at all the cumulative risk factors, which is the one that we should probably be most concerned about if we were to name one? This is what she says. It says, different studies in various countries have shown that children reared by lone parents are at a serious disadvantage, that they are not necessarily at any disadvantage, that they may have advantages over children brought up in 2-parent households. The conclusion to be drawn is not necessarily that some or all of the research is flawed, but that it depends. And what the results of lone parent rearing or any other specific factor depend on is other factors. She says, it is the concept of cumulative risk factors in children's lives that makes research findings like these comprehensible. In post-industrial Western countries, where family patterns are in flux and their reality is often at odds with the ideals of the society in which they are located, lone parenting is a risk factor for children. In other words, raising a family in a single-parent home is a risk factor. But the magnitude of the risk depends on a wide range of family relationships and circumstances. Gradually, we are learning to identify some of the risk factors that, piled one upon the other, make rotten results for children cumulatively more likely. The more we learn, the clearer it becomes that in post-industrial societies, at least, poverty is the biggest risk factor of all. So there are many, many factors, many concerns that you listed, many, many, many factors that influence whether children are going to do well or not. And without meaning to downplay any of them, what I would like to focus on, the main focus of today's session, is to look at the risk factor of poverty. So, you can turn off the tape for a minute, and I'm... moving right along, we're just going to go to a different topic. No, I'll explain what we just did. For those listening to the tape, what I had people do was to line up for the race for wages. And we had measured out, and I didn't quite explain this to the people who were running far. We had this measured out in a 100-yard block. So people who are listening to the tape could actually draw a football field to get an image of what we're doing. And I had people run different distances. Now, let's start with how many of you ended up on the 1 foot line? Okay. The 1 foot line, what that indicates in this run for the wages is you were full-time workers earning minimum wage. So the 1 foot line got you $10,500. Okay, that's what that 1 foot illustrates. All right, so you're minimum wage workers, you're working full time, you're working hard. That's why I had you keep pumping. It's not that you're not working, it's just that you didn't get very far. Okay, now those of you on the 2 foot line, I actually have bad news for you because we just pushed you back a half a yard. So now you're really at the 1.5 yard line. Mm-hmm. And your wages illustrate what happens to you if you're a family of four living at the poverty line. That gets you $16,500, family of four living at the poverty line. So that's the wages that's living at the poverty line, family of four. How many of you got to the 1 yard line? Okay, those of you who got to the 1 yard line, you represent the average salary of an industrial worker in our country, which is $34,000 a year. So you got to the you got $34,000. Got to the 1 yard line. Now, there were four of you, and I know Jim is one. I'm going to hold Jim off for a minute. But four of you, my goodness, you had a long way to go. And Jim, now, excluding you for a minute, how far did three of you have to go? 350 yards. Okay. What do you suppose that represents? It's the average CEO salary in the United States. 350 yards. And just to give you an idea, I put the salary, I just heard this on the radio a week or so before I came. Jim Martin Schramm, what does yours say, Jim? Okay, Jim had to run 4,700 yards. Wow. And that's what the CEO of The Gap made this year.
The Gap?
The Gap.
And what is that?
$450 million.
Wow.
Okay. Now, there's one other wage worker that I included, and I just had two of them. You got to the 1-inch line. Who are you? Okay. You got to the 1-inch line. Now, if any of you were here with me last week, I did a week on U.S. foreign policy, and I looked at changes that are taking place in the global economy and what that has to do with U.S. foreign policy. And we saw a very brief video, or clips from a video, that introduced us to a woman named Rosa Martinez. And Rosa Martinez, she shows up in advertisements of U.S. companies and people in El Salvador saying, move your operations to El Salvador because you can hire Rosa Martinez. First, it was for 57 cents an hour. Now the ads after the North American Free Trade Agreement are that you can hire her for 33 cents an hour. So working at 38 cents an hour, which was another wage given for workers in El Salvador, that doesn't get you up to the 1-inch line. You're just shy of the 1-inch line. Now, of course, one question you might have is, well, yeah, this might not look so good, but in our country, it just doesn't affect that many people. So let's try to illustrate it. And what I would like to do is, if someone, when I read off a state, I would like you to stand up and remember the state that you're assigned to. So if I say Minnesota, if you'll stand up, she is representing the entire population of the state of Minnesota. And that's what we're going to do. I'm going to just keep rattling off states. And okay, so we got Minnesota up. How about all the people of Iowa? Hey, they're now up. South Dakota. North Dakota. Wisconsin. Kansas. Nebraska. Wyoming. Vermont. Arkansas. And again, if you can try to remember which state you are. Delaware. Montana. Rhode Island. New Hampshire. Indiana. Maine. Nevada. New Mexico, going down the list here. West Virginia. Utah. Arizona, if you can just keep going down. Missouri. Colorado. Then let's go up on top, have a few people stand up. Alabama, would you be Alabama, please? And go around. Oklahoma, would you stand for Oklahoma? Hawaii, would you be Hawaii, please? And then, let's see, Idaho, someone would be Idaho up there. Kentucky, Tennessee, and North Carolina. Now, if we were to add up all the people in all of those states, we get the number of people in the United States that are living below, at, or just a fraction above the poverty level in the United States. It's the total population of 31 of our states. So what I'd like you to do is just really quickly rattle off really loud for us all to hear and try to get the collective impact of what we're talking about here, each of these states.
Minnesota.
Iowa.
South Dakota.
North Dakota.
Wisconsin.
Kansas.
Nebraska.
Wyoming.
Vermont.
Arkansas.
Delaware.
Montana.
Rhode Island.
New Hampshire.
Indiana.
Maine.
Nevada.
New Mexico.
West Virginia.
Utah.
Arizona.
Missouri.
Colorado.
Alabama.
Oklahoma.
Hawaii.
Idaho.
Kentucky.
Tennessee.
North Carolina.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it? You can sit down now. Now, to be fair, you'll notice I didn't have California on there. I didn't have New York. I didn't have Texas. I didn't have the big states. But it still gives you an idea. The total population of 31 of our states, over 65 million people. And if Penelope Leach is right, that poverty is the number one risk factor, the most important risk factor among many, we can begin to understand why family crisis might be deepening. Now, I want to have a lot of time for conversation, but I want to just sketch and say a few words about how and why this happened. There were some major changes in this country that were deepened in 1980 and have been continuing ever since. And those changes involve let me first illustrate what happened. In 1980, if we were to add up all the incomes of the poorest 20% of our people, it would have added up in 1980 to the incomes of the upper 1% of U.S. income earners. So our top 1% had an income greater than the bottom 20% of all income earners. By 1990, just 10 years later, that income of that 1% was now equal to 40% of all the workers in our country. That's a really dramatic increase. Now, when you think about, a lot of people think the economy is doing really well. We're supposed to be living in the longest peacetime, explosive, growing economy, probably maybe even in our history. It's supposed to be really, really good times. The problem is that who benefits from that? It doesn't seep down real far. It doesn't reach poor families in particular. And a couple of illustrations of that. If I were to ask you of the income gains, if we were to measure national income, in other words, add up our national income in 1980 and then see where it was in 1990, it was a big, big increase in national income, okay? Prosperity. Now, what percentage of the income gains would you guess went to the upper 20%? 20% of U.S. income earners.
80%.
80%. 90%. Cynics. What else? 98%. So 98% of all the income gains in the country went from between 1980 and 1990, and actually this is accelerating since then, went to the upper 20% of U.S. incomers. That means that 80% of the U.S. people were working with a 2% of that national increase. Not very much. By the way, 70% of the income gains went to the upper 1%. It's very, very concentrated. We live in the most unequal of all industrial countries, and inequality is growing faster here than anywhere else. Now, the question is, well, let me give you one other figure. What happens if incomes are really wide in terms of disparity over time? What happens is you have entrenched wealth differentials. Income differentials turn into wealth differentials. And so in our country, the richest 1% have a net worth greater than 90% of the population. The richest 1% have more wealth than 90% than the wealth of 90% added up altogether. That is just astounding, and it is accelerating. Now, let me just offer one other kind of historical note, put this in context, and then I'm going to ask you to get into small groups for a few minutes and respond to this a little bit, but also to think about what we might do differently if we wanted to level things out a little bit, because there are mechanisms to do that. Anybody remember when Ronald Reagan was running for president and he was elected in 1980, he said, he promised the American people that he would do three things if he were elected. Do you remember what they were?
Cut taxes.
Cut taxes was one.
Increase military
spending. That was two. What was the other one?
The third one.
What's that?
He forgot the third
one. I didn't say that. I just repeated what I heard over in the second row. The third one was to balance the budget. To balance the budget. Now, so balance the budget, reduce taxes, increase military spending. Well, I'll tell you in a minute about how we reduce taxes selectively. We definitely dramatically increased military spending, and the budget deficit went from $1 trillion to $4.4 trillion during the Reagan-Bush years. Now, what's important to note is David Stockman was Reagan's first budget director. And David Stockman said publicly, "We knew it wouldn't work." He said, "We knew it wasn't going to happen." He said, "What we wanted to build up were strategic deficits." Now, I'll tell you about a strategic deficit in a minute, what that means. And if I don't, please remind me. All right, well, let's look at how did this wealth transfer happen? I mean, how did this happen? A lot of it has to do with the tax system. So, for example, just a few more statistics. In 1965, if I were making a lot of money, the government wanted quite a bit of it after a certain point. So, for example, the top individual tax rate was 91% on income over $400,000. Now, there were loopholes that you could try to get around, but it, basically that's some people would call that thievery, other people would call it progressive taxation. 91 cents out of every dollar that I made after 400,000, which I could live on quite nicely, I'm sure, was to be taken in taxes. In 1979, that 91% rate had already been reduced to, I think it was 73%. It was either 73 or 70. I have all these statistics, by the way, in this book of mine called Families Valued. And if you want to get a copy, they ordered them, but if they didn't come in the bookstore, you can see me. So 73%. Well, after Reagan and Bush were elected, they reduced the upper rate to 28%. Now, that's a big drop, from 91% to 28%. And that big drop meant billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars for the richest U.S. citizens. Now, let me just say, with that, you know that the budget was in deficit. We weren't taking in the money. As I say, we went from a $1 trillion debt to a $4.4 trillion debt during the Bush-Reagan years. What they did do, however, is they slashed a lot of programs. They slashed food stamps. They slashed housing. They slashed a lot of programs because of the budget deficit. And that's what David Stockman meant when he said we wanted to have strategic deficits. Now, if you were here last week, I talked about how debt in the third world, or two-thirds world, became an Achilles heel for them because it allowed rich countries to go in and say, you're in debt, you need more money. If you want more money, you better get your labor unions in line. You better increase your agricultural exports to pay the bankers. You better be willing to cut down those rainforests in order to pay off the bankers. You better be willing to do a whole structural adjustment package that we dictate. Well, what the strategic deficits did in this country was play a similar role. You could come along and say, wouldn't it be nice to have national health insurance for everybody? We have 48 million U.S. citizens that don't have health insurance. And they could come back and say, oh, well, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe it's not a good idea. But, you know, with these budget deficits, we can't even talk about it. We can't even think about it. That's what a strategic deficit allows you to do. It allows you to basically short-circuit creative ideas for living in a different kind of society, and that's how it was used. Well, what I'd like you to think about, I'd like you to think about two questions in small groups, and after I ask these questions, maybe I'll ask that the tape be turned off again until you're ready to report back. One is, I'd like you to think about what kind of pressures, and maybe some of you are in this situation so you know them very well, but if not, I want you to use your imaginations. What kind of pressures do you think you would feel in your family if you were trying to raise your family and you were on that 1 foot line or that 2 foot line? In other words, if you were living at or near that poverty level or if you were earning minimum wage, what would that be like? What additional obstacles would that make for you as you try to parent responsibly? That's the first question. The second question I would ask you to think about is what kinds of public policies can you envision that could reverse this trend? Reverse the trend of income disparities or lessen its impact? In other words, what kind of social policies could we do? If poverty is a leading indicator of children not doing well, what could we do through governmental policy that would help? Okay, those are my two questions. Let's say 5 minutes. 7 minutes. 7 minutes and see what you come up with, and we'll report back. You can turn the tape off now. Just to have a few comments about what added difficulties do you face if you're living on that 1 yard line or that 1 foot line?
One inch.
Helping develop the children's self-esteem and building up to break the cycle.
You're kind of trapped in that.
Child care.
How do you afford child care?
Yeah.
Huge expense.
Big worries about your children's safety.
Where could you afford to live, standing on that 1 foot on the 1 foot line? Housing in where we live would absorb most of your income. Child care would be out of the question. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. How do you have time to look for another job if you were so stuck and so strapped? There'd be no leeway.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you're really kind of stuck there. How would you find a good job? Yeah.
We were also thrown in that you'd be very dependent on extended family. You'd be constantly leaning on your relatives to help, like the child care question. Others of the family would have to be in there with you to help survive.
And if you didn't have that support, then what?
SOL.
You're out of luck.
You're out of luck.
But you would also be using those kinds of resources, whether or not you deem them to be safe or good for your children, because, again, no choices.
Meals around the table would not probably be very common. Plus, the food that is at the table would probably be less nutritious than if you had a little bit more money.
Healthcare is a biggie because you're probably uninsured, and so you get healthcare only when it's an emergency, which means childhood asthma, those kinds of things really increase.
I remember visiting Montana a few years ago and meeting some mothers who were just absolutely torn. They hated they didn't really like being on the welfare system. But if they went out and got a job, they would lose their health care. And that was the position that they were in over and over and over again. Well, we could go on, but I think what I'm trying to get across here is that the poverty is not just an isolated, pocketed problem in our society. With the growing gap between the rich and the poor, with kind of a two-tier or maybe even three-tier wage system now, in which one out of every five workers in this country now works full-time and lives in poverty. That's pretty astounding. So it gives us a sense, I think, an appreciation for the difficulty that children and families face. Now on the other end, that other question, what kind of public policy? Public policies can't solve every problem, but they can make a pretty significant difference if that circle is healthy. What kinds of public policies would be helpful? What did you say there?
Just taxation.
Okay, just taxation.
That could be a flat tax, because that would tax everybody and avoid all the loopholes in which the very wealthy can get around.
The attraction of a flat tax is that everybody pays the same, there are no loopholes. But every study that I have seen indicates that the flat tax will absolutely aggravate income inequalities. And so it sounds really simple, but those are the studies that I've seen. Some form of taxation because taxation, quite frankly, taxation is one of the only mechanisms that we have for some leveling, for some redistribution of unequal wages. What else? Yes?
Inheritance taxes, capital gains taxes.
So other taxes, not just income taxes. Thank
also
you.
Raise minimum wage to make it more of a living wage.
Raising the minimum wage. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to try to actually live on a minimum wage salary. And there are proposals to do that. So that is an option. They just don't go very far. But certainly that's one. There's a lot of living wage initiatives in our state, in the state of Minnesota, in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul. There's efforts underway that any corporations that get subsidies beyond so many thousands of dollars are under legislation now being considered would be forced to pay living wages, which I think were defined as about $20,000 for a family of three, something like that. Others?
Subsidized daycare.
Yeah.
Other
societies, if you've spent time elsewhere, France has free daycare available from ages 1 through 6, I think it is, publicly funded, just as public school systems are funded. What else?
Public transportation.
Oh, go ahead.
Public transportation,
real commitment to public transportation.
I say along with the daycare thing, I think some of the Scandinavian countries actually invest in mothers staying home with their children for the first 2 or 3 years.
And fathers. There's very good paternal leave. Yeah, so there's a value placed on children and a value placed on the bonding of children with mother and father. And the rules are that you can't lose your job for doing that. And I believe you get about 90% of your salary when you're on leave.
I want to say something. When I was pregnant, I went through these parenting classes with other women, and I was kind of mad because a woman on welfare was going to get paid after her baby was born to stay home, and I had to get no income to stay home with my baby. So I mean, to tell you the truth, it rubbed me the wrong way.
Well, and that's...
I asked her, are you going back to work? Oh, no, I'll go back on welfare. Yeah. And whereas I was making a choice of just cutting my income to be home.
And I think one of the things that, that's one of the reasons that programs, if they're means tested, but they're means tested in a reasonable way or in a reasonably generous way, then you don't have those kind of divisions. I think that those divisions keep us oftentimes from pursuing public policies that would be beneficial to you and to her situation, your situation. And it creates that kind of bitterness, which creates, I think, the kind of mean-spirited politics which has guided public policy in this country over the last decade or two.
I'd like to just point out a situation that we have in Canada. We do have welfare, I think maybe easier than you have, but what we're experiencing in Canada, I think, is that we have second and third generations of welfare people. And my experience, I live just two doors away from a welfare family. They have lost their ability to know what's right or wrong within the society. For example, all winter, they could not walk across into the bush and glean firewood for their wood stove. They stole it from my next door neighbor. Now we were cold. But they don't seem to have the sense of responsibility in society anymore. And yet they don't want to go out and work for them to help themselves.
Well, just two quick comments. One comment would be, from my vantage point, welfare reform is a really good idea. From my vantage point, the way we did welfare reform in this country, which was, well, let me give you an example. In 1994, in the congressional elections in 1994, nearly 50% of the voters who voted in that election, according to exit polls, thought either welfare or food stamps, or I mean, welfare or foreign aid were the number one items in the U.S. federal budget. Now, they each made up less than 1% of the federal budget. Now, welfare reform, we had welfare reform. I think what pushed welfare reform were really a lot of wrong ideas, a lot of wrong things. But I think the system doesn't function very well, so it needs reforming. I think that's what you're pointing out. But the other thing I would point out is that in our country, it's really a relatively small percentage of the impoverished population that are on welfare. I mean, that's part of what I tried to illustrate when we look at the total population of 65 states who are living on or at the margins. And when we recognize that 80% of the people who don't have health insurance in this country are workers, or that one out of five full-time workers are living in poverty. So it's acknowledging that I think that there is a problem within welfare, and there's a problem of creating dependencies. But we should focus on those as the typical profile of poor people in our society, because I don't think that would hold. I don't think that would hold. Any others? Well, let me just bring this to a close. We just have a couple of minutes, and just say that I think there are many public policies that would help, and you've named the numbers of them. If wages are, some economists argue that wages need to, if we raise the minimum wage significantly, that's going to have a really bad impact on the economy. Well, if that's true, then there are other things that we can do. Some of you are probably familiar with a program called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is supposed to try to reward the working poor by by increasing their income at least slightly. It's very modest. It's very modest, but there could be a lot more done there. Or if we actually think that that you know we got to have some of these low wage workers, low wages don't matter as much if you have subsidized daycare, or you have daycare available, or if you have national health insurance, if you have some of those essential things you need. But when you link low wages with no housing programs, with no medical stuff, then you have a prescription for a social disaster as well as a personal disaster, it seems to me. So there are many, many things like that. One other one that I'll mention. Means testing programs makes a lot of sense to me. How many of you own homes or are buying homes? Quite a few of you. You have benefited from something called an home mortgage interest deduction. But 80% of the benefit of that home mortgage interest deduction goes to the richest 20% of U.S. citizens. If we were just to restrict, say you can only write off $20,000 a year of taxes of your home mortgage each year, that would have paid for the entire federal cost of food stamps and welfare paid together, put together, for example. So we need to look at priorities as well. All right, well, this is just a focus. I wrote this book, Families Valued, because I was really frustrated that the families, the people talking loudest about family values, which I think are important, were the ones that were pursuing public policies that were undermining families and neighborhoods. And I think we've got to get consistent. We've got to look at what's going on in each of those three circles. So next time we're going to focus on issues of violence, the culture, and the promises of the culture. Thank you very much.